Today is November the 22nd, 1996. I have a sponsor. He's actually aware of that fact. He has a sponsor who's aware of that too, and he's even aware of me. I have a good life here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm really happy to come and share my experience, strength, and hope, because I have a lot of all. But one of my favorite things about AA is that we are not a glum lot. And so I'd like to start with a little bit of humor. This is one of my favorites. There was an Irish bar in Manhattan, and one day this genuine Irishman walks in, and he walks up and he says, "I'd like 3 pints of Guinness, please." And the bartender says, "Sure," and he puts 3 pints down, and the guy goes over to his booth, and he sits down, he puts one here, one here, one here, picks up one, sips it, 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 picks up one. And finally, he gets all done with him, and he goes back up to the bar, and he says, and the bartender, he says, "I'll have 3 more Guinness," and he says, "Excuse me, sir, I don't mean to tell you how to drink, but, you know, after I pull these pints, they start to warm up and go flat. Wouldn't it be better if you just drank one at a time?" And the man says, "Oh, no, 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 you don't understand. I have 2 brothers back in Dublin." And he said, "And when we all parted ways, we decided that whenever we drank, we will drink like this to honor each other." The bartender said, "That's the coolest thing I've ever heard. I love that." So, of course, the guy came in, he became a regular, and everybody knew the story. Everyone knew the story and thought it was just absolutely wonderful. And then one day the man came in and he said, "I'll have 2 pints of Guinness, please." And he gives him the 2 pints and the whole bar is a buzz, like, "Oh, no. And so when he comes up and they're empty, he says, "I'll have 2 more. And he says, "Sir, I don't mean to intrude into your private grief, but," he said, "I want you to know that everyone in this bar is so sorry about your brother." And the man looks at him. He looks at the pints, he looks up and he says, "Oh, no, no, my brothers are fine. I just quit drinking." True alcoholic. True alcoholic. So, you know, again, we're not a glum lot, and that's typical of us. So I was born in Detroit, Michigan, to 2 non-alcoholic parents. I'm an only child. And my dad, this is really funny. My mom got tipsy once, didn't like it, got dizzy and threw up, and that was the end of it when she was a teenager. My dad got drunk once, really drunk, and the hangover was so bad he said that isn't worth it. So he never did it. They were truly social drinkers on occasion, like if a family event, they would have a cocktail. Their cocktails were very weak, believe me, I tried them. And so I grew up in this household that would seemingly prevent me from becoming an alcoholic. And in fact, that very thought that people, alcoholics came from alcoholics, helped me to believe that I wasn't an alcoholic for a very long time. But my mother was a sugar addict. And we all know what alcohol does in our system. It turns to sugar. And if sugar addiction sounds this far removed from alcoholism, let me share with you how this worked. When I was a kid, when I was born, my mother had gained some weight and was having a hard time getting it off. And my father was trying to help her. Now, it wasn't abusive or "I want you to be a trophy wife." My father thought my mother was the most beautiful woman he ever saw to the day she died at 72. But he wanted her to be healthy, and she wanted to be healthy, and he was trying to help her. So she would go to him and she'd say, "Look, Jim, I'm having my 3 cousins over for lunch and I need to have a dessert." And he'd say, "Well, okay, but please, when I get home from work, I'd like to see just 3 pieces out of the cake." And she'd say, "Oh yeah, no problem. So I would come home from school, and my mom and I, as my father used to say, were thick like thieves. And she'd say, "Do you want a piece of cake?" And I'd say, "Sure." So I'd go in, and there was usually like more like 5 pieces gone from the cake already. And I'd have a piece, and she'd have a piece. And I'd have a piece, and she'd have a piece. "Do you want another one?" All right, just a little one. And finally, my mother would look at the cake, and she'd say, "Oh, my God, look at this. Your father's going to have a fit." So we would do the only thing logical people would do. There was a bakery called Ori's in Detroit, and they delivered. And you had a little sign, and you put it in your front window. And if the guy saw the Ori sign, he'd pull over, and he had one of those, like almost those peanut-selling things from the ballpark. but it was two layered. And he would come up and he would have all the things that he knew you liked, like a drug dealer, you know? And he would come up and he would have what you wanted and what you might need, like milk or bread. And so my mother would pick another cake that she had had for the luncheon. And then we would go in the kitchen, polish off cake one, destroy the evidence in the trash out back, and then eat three pieces out of the next cake, and then never say that that was the cake, but let my dad draw his own conclusions. And we did that all through my childhood. And that plays an important part later on. So that by the time I was in high school, when I was a high school senior, I weighed 285 pounds. I was a big guy. I weigh about 170 right now. That's a lot of weight on a guy who's 5'6". So that was the beginning of my obsessive compulsive behaviors. Now, I'd always thought that I would like drinking because I like what I saw on TV. I like what people did when they were drunk on TV. So when I was 15, now I'd get a little glass of wine from my dad or sip of somebody's beer and all that, but never too much. I never had any of my own. I didn't know friends that could get a hold of it. But when I was 15, I went on a class trip. I was a freshman in high school. I was in parochial high school. And we went to Mexico. And I don't know what you know about Mexico, but Mexico has, this is their liquor law. If you can reach the bar and you have the cash, you can have a drink. And if you can't reach the bar, they'll get you a box to stand on. So they allowed all of us to drink. And I got absolutely, pardon me, shit-faced drunk. And in true alcoholic style, at the most inconvenient moment, the night that we were going to get on a bus and go to Acapulco at midnight. So I come staggering up to the bus. It was obvious to everybody I was drunk. They took me into the bathroom and made me put my fingers down my throat and throw up so I wouldn't throw up on the bus. And I had a miserable night on the way to Acapulco. And you know what? I couldn't wait to do it again. I liked the way it made me feel. For the first time, I could sit among people that I thought were cool and feel like was one of them. Because I never in my whole life, my family was different than other families. We didn't go bowling, we watched TV. We didn't play sports. My dad was a reader and my mother was a reader. And we did things that were different than everybody else. And I just was never comfortable in my own skin. Nor was, I think, my family, to be honest with you. So I went through high school. Believe me, I got in big trouble when I got home, and a very careful eye was kept on me. But when I got to the end of high school, I had a friend named Mark Herkimer. I met him as a sophomore in high school. He became my best friend. He's still my best friend to this day. Over 50 years of friendship. He lives down in Houston. But his parents had a philosophy, and it was this. I know you guys are going to go out and drink. I don't want you out drinking and driving. So you can drink here. We could drink at their house. So at 16, 17, I could drink at the Herkimers. Now, my parents weren't aware of this, and my parents didn't really know the Herkimers, but they were good people, and they were trying to keep us all out of trouble. And then we had another friend, Mary Lou, who had graduated before us, and she got married, and we would go over to her house, and we could drink, and we could smoke pot. So that kind of started escalating. 16, 17, I got out of high school, and at 19, I decided I needed to move out of the house because I couldn't drink and use like I wanted to. And if I moved out with my buddy Mark, we could do whatever we wanted to, and we did. And it just was really kind of out of control in no time. Not only the increase in drinking, but the going to hard liquor rather than just beer or wine. And of course, it was always cheap stuff. So, you know, it was always like, you know, Mad Dog and playing games of the game. I don't know. Anybody remember the game Pass Out? A board game that you would play. And I started working at Kmart, and my boss and I got drunk and used together. We thought we were so sophisticated. We'd do import beer night, you know, which meant we drank Foster's, which was a really big can, you know. So you could say, I only had two, you know, but it was more like, I don't know, four or six or who knows how many. So we just went crazy like that. When I got to be 21, I realized that Kmart wasn't really how I wanted to spend the rest of my life. And so I went to college, and I said, you know what, I'm going to pull way back on all of this. I still had the ability to pull back, and started in college. I ended up on the dean's list my first two years in college. I was studying theater arts. That was my passion. That's still my passion. It's still what I do, which I'm very fortunate to say that, because a lot of people, when we get sober, we can't necessarily do what we did. But at any rate, so I went in there, and I was exercising every morning, and I was studying hard, and I was doing all this. But after a couple of years, and then working in the department, because, you know, a theater degree is no good unless you get experience. And so I started doing everything I could learn, because I didn't have a good program when I was in high school or even in grade school. So I'm learning this, and of course, it wasn't long before I met the kind of people who drank like I drank, and use like I used. So it kind of got back into that. And so the most important thing was the show, the using. The show, the drinking. And we didn't have any money, so we would drink, I don't know, anybody remember Falstaff beer with the $2.99 a 12 pack and a fine liquor. And when you popped off the cap, they had a concentration puzzle in the cap. So that's how we would think that made it more intellectual, you know. Did that through college, got out of college, worked at the Detroit Historical Museum, worked for them for a year or so, continued to use and drink to my heart's content without getting fired or anything, and then decided I was gonna that I didn't want to continue working there, so I went back to school, and I got a master's and. I got a Master of Fine Arts degree, and I really pulled back a lot. I really don't know how I did it. When I was a grad student, I assisted two professors. I taught two sections of speech. I was in four shows that year, and I held a part-time job outside of the university. I don't know how I did that, but I did it, and I did it by moderating a lot. So things really, really got bad when I decided to move to New York, because I had a Master of Fine Arts degree, and everybody I knew in my class was going to New York or to LA or places like that, and I thought, I would need to do that. I'm going to go to New York. So I moved to New York with two of my best friends, Dale and Tim, and they both had undergrad degrees. They were actors. I was a technician. Technicians in New York get work really easily. I knew people at some of the biggest shops in the city, my classmates, friends of theirs, people that I'd worked with over the summers. And so I went right in, and my buddy Tim was like way, way up at a place called Barbara Matera's shop. And any Broadway show that went up on Broadway in the 90s, I moved there in 91, went through Barbara Matera's shop. You saw Glenn Close, and you saw Liza Minnelli, and you saw Robert De Niro, all of those people were always running around in the shop. So I felt like I'd really arrived. And then Tim introduced me to this bar called Splash, where they had a 2-for-1 happy hour that started at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And Tim always had a happy hour going at the house, and he'd be cooking dinner, and we'd have friends over, And then Tim introduced me to probably the worst thing that ever happened in my life, and that was cocaine. Tim did a lot of cocaine. And I thought, he's right up there. This is how the big guys play. They drink heavy, they use coke, and they make it, baby. They make it big. And so I started doing that too. And when I went from my previous two roommates, because honestly, they started getting really jealous because they weren't getting anywhere as actors. That's really hard. And we got into disagreements, and they both moved away. So I moved in with Tim, and that was the beginning of the end. So we were doing all this kind of craziness, and Tim finally said he had a job out in Kansas at his alma mater, University of Kansas, Manhattan. And when he came back, he said, hey, man, I said, oh, you want to get high? And he's like, you know what? I can't do coke anymore. He says, I'm going to end up being able to pick my nose with my fist. And I said, oh, and he goes, but that's okay. I found a new way to do coke. And we were drinking scotch, and he's drinking bourbon, and we were both kind of, and he said, you can smoke it. Can you? So he showed me how to do that in a spoon with baking soda and water, and he handed me this pipe, and I took a big hit, and he looked at me and he goes, oh, by the way, you know this is crack, right? Oh, no. Very naive of me. But I have to tell you, I've always said I was addicted on the first hit, because I used to tell people, with my addictive personality, I don't even want to look at crack, because God knows I don't need that. But the minute I did that, I thought, well, what's the big deal about this? This isn't bad. So a year later of doing that, I decided I have to do something. This is getting out of control. I'm going to die in New York. And when you die in New York, there's a good chance they're never going to find you. Yeah, you know, you'd be in the East River, you know, underneath the undercut, you know. And so I said, I've got to do something. I've got to do something radical. So I did. I did the most logical thing I could think of to do. I moved. I moved from there. I found a job at Actors Theater in Louisville, Kentucky. And I thought, well, Kentucky's a good old boy state. I'll bet they don't have any drugs there. This would be great. And the first day I drove into town, there was a liquor store that the front plate was knocked out, and they put a plywood thing on it, and somebody wrote in spray paint, "The Legal Dope House." Well, that's not good. I had a job with a boss who hated me from day one, and this wasn't going well. So I went out and I hooked up with this guy named Mike, and he helped me find my way around Louisville to the bars, to the dope houses, to all of that. And everything in a year started crashing down on me to the point that I thought, this is bad. I thought it was bad in New York. This is horrible. By the way, as a little side note, that guy Mike that I was hanging with, we looked him up this year, and I found out he's in the Eastern Kentucky Correctional Facility, life and 70 years for murder. That was the kind of people I was hanging with. And so I had a thing going on. That summer I lost my job at Actors Theater of Louisville, rightly so. If I wasn't drunk, I was high. If I wasn't high, I was drunk. When I got drunk, I wanted to get high. You know, it was the same thing in New York. I'd say, I'm not going to do the drugs. I can't do the drugs. But I'll go to happy hour with them, and I get three drinks in me, and I'm like, ring, ring, hello. And that's how it would go. It was always connected to the drinking. It always started with the drinking. And so my dad had prostate cancer in 1988. And he had his prostate out, and he was doing pretty well. But in 1996, when all of this started falling apart, my dad they'd found a tumor on his right kidney. And they determined that it was malignant, and they had to have it out. But I was pretending I was trying to get my shit together in Louisville, but I was really ripping and running, and my dad had this surgery and had his kidney out. And I had this one last ditch job, and I was scared to death, because I knew when I got that next paycheck, I knew where it was all going. I knew exactly where it was all going. I thought, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I got a phone call at the theater that night, and I still had a week to go on this thing. And it was my mom on the phone, because, oh, by the way, at my apartment, I didn't have lights, I didn't have a phone. I sometimes didn't even know where the car was. And in fact, I didn't, because I had loaned it to a drug dealer, and it was gone. And my mom said, you have to come home. Your dad's not doing well. You got to come home. And I thought, oh, shit. And I said, well, right as soon as this show, no, tomorrow. I want you here tomorrow. And I said, okay. So I thought, I do. So I went to a college professor of mine who lived in Louisville, and his name was Bob. And I said, Bob, I think my dad's dying. I have to get to Detroit, and I don't know where the car is. And he said, don't explain. So he said, how do you want to go there? And he said, do you want to fly? And I said, and I looked at flights and I said, no, that's too expensive. I'm never going to be able to pay you back as it is. Because I had gone to him many times for money. And money that I never even thought about repaying because I was just desperate. And he said, I looked up a bus to Louisville to Detroit. And I said, I can take this bus. And he said, what do you need? And I said, can I have 100? And so he gave me 100 and he drove me to the bus station and he said, okay, good luck. And he got out of the car and he drove away. And he drove away because I don't think he believed I was really going to get a bus ticket. I think he really thought I was just going to take that money and go get wasted. But I did get the bus ticket. And I got on the bus and I was riding up there and I thought, God, my life is a mess. How am I going to do this? How am I going to put this back together? And I thought, you know what? I've got 5 hours to think about how to get this together. So I'm trying to figure it out. And you know what? It didn't add up. It wasn't going to work. Because I wasn't doing the show and I wasn't going to get the money and I wasn't going to have my rent and they were going to throw me out. And I don't know what I was going to find when my dad died. And so I've said for the first time in my life what I will call the first honest prayer of my life. I say, God, help me. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to turn. Please help me. And I went on and, you know, it wasn't like I didn't have a white light moment like Bill W. or anything like that. But I felt a little peace, and I was able to get a little sleep, and I got to Detroit, and the bus takes you to downtown Detroit. So I called my mom, and I said, Mom, can somebody come get me? And she said, take a cab. All right. I thought, oh, I hope I have enough money. And there was nobody there. There was no one at the bus. It was like 11:30 at night. And so I looked around, and a cab pulled up. And I went in, and it was this middle-aged hippie guy, you know, the long hair. Yeah, typical hippie in the early 90s, right? And I said, can you help me? I need to get to Redford Township, the west side of Detroit. And he said, yeah. I said, I know you're not going to get a fare back. He said, it's okay, man, get in. He's like, I put my bag in the back seat, and we're driving along, and he wanted to talk, and I didn't want to talk. It's like, what's going on? I said, well, my dad's really bad, and I don't know. I think he might be dying. And of course, think of me at like 140 pounds. You know, I probably look like hammered, you know what. And he started talking to me about life and you know, hardship. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, you know what he says? I don't usually say this to people in my cab. He says, I don't think it's, you know, it's probably worth more than my job. But he said, I think I want to tell you this. And I said, what's that? He says, I think I know some people that can help you. And I thought, how do you know how you can help me? I had never said anything about what was really going on in my life. And he said, well, I'm part of a group called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, you don't understand, man. You don't understand. You don't get it. But the seed was planted. And I got to my house, and my cousin's car was in the driveway, and my cousin was like the matriarch of the family. And I thought, oh, God, Maggie's here. Dad's dead. She's here helping my mom through this. And I walked in the front door, and there was Maggie on the sofa and my mom. And I saw something on the corner. And I looked over. My dad's sitting in the recliner, and I'm like, Dad, okay, Mom, what's going on? What's wrong with Dad? What's happening? And my mom stood up, and she said, Son, we know what's going on in your life and we want to help you if you want it. I thought, thank you, God. Answer to my prayer. And my cousin took me to Herman Kiefer Hospital the next morning at 7 a.m., in spite of how late it was when she left. And we went in there and he said, hey, how bad is your problem? Because they were taking people at 7 o'clock in the morning to discern where you're going to go. And I said, mister, if I don't stop, I'm going to die. That's all there is to it. I'm going to die, and soon. If I don't die from the drugs and the alcohol, one of these people I'm around is going to kill me. And he said, well, we've got a thing, and we, you know, it's not what most people want to hear. It's called, we have a bed for you in Share House. And I said, Share House, what's that? He said, self-help addiction rehabilitation. He said, it's a military-based program based on a psychiatric, it's a recovery community not a treatment center. And I said, well, I don't understand what that means. And he said, so it's military-based. There's a psychiatric format that they follow. And so on Friday morning, I walked into Share House at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I was waiting for them to come get me. And there are all these people, all these, you know, really nice people working there, and they seem really, really pleasant. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go. So I went up to this guy. His name was David. And I said, excuse me, sir. I would just have a question. He goes, oh, they're going to come get you in a minute. And I said, well, I know. I said, I just have a question. What are the people like here? And he said, what do you mean, what are the people like? I said, you know, the residents. What are the residents like here? And he said, sir, I am one of the residents. All of us out here are residents. We run the house. We do all the work of the house. He said, and I thought to myself, if that guy's a resident, he's got something I want. He's happy. He's joyous. He's free. And I want some of that. So if that, whatever, I said, God, whatever they tell me to do, I'll do it. They tell me to go take off my clothes and stand naked in the corner of my head, I'll go do it. Whatever it takes. So I got in there, and they were right. It was, they said, you might see fights. You might see a drug dealer break in and try and find somebody who owes them money. You might see some really ugly stuff. He said, just be ready for whatever it is. But the way they did it was, they would say to you, we couldn't talk through a page. We had to walk with a buddy. You couldn't talk with a woman without another woman with you, so that it could be witness to what, you know, whether you were being appropriate or not with women, or women with men, same way. So they would come up to you and they would say, I was James M.C., because there was already a James M. They say, James M.C., assume a posture for talking through a page. Walk over to the wall, stand like that, and they tell you what a worthless piece of shit you are. How you're a useless drug addict and you ought to be grateful to be here. And there was only one, appropriate response. Thank you, sir. I'll take a look at that. And my sponsor once said, wouldn't it be great if every time we had a conflict, you looked at the person and said, thank you, I'll take a look at that. Rather than go you know what yourself. They went through that, and the first day they had a group meeting, this guy named Attila Jackson, the most exuberant human being I've ever met in my life, and he was what they called an upper house resident. He was working there, but he had gone through the program. He came in and he said, good news, everybody. And we're all like, oh, good, we're going to get an extra smoke break. He said, you don't have to drink again. You don't have to use again. And that was the first time anyone had ever said that to me, because I thought I had to use. I thought I had to drink. So we went through that. And of course, they had all kinds of things for you. I mean, the other guy came in, that was the good cop. The bad cop came in and they were talking about things that were going to happen around the house. And they got some grumbling out of the group. And his response was, look, dope fiends, if you don't like the way we do things around here, pack your MFing roach bags and hit the door, because the effing thing isn't locked from the inside. And that's how they felt about it. And you know what? I came out of there learning how to confront my own out-of-order behavior and other people's. They had a philosophy, and I'd like to share it with you because it's stuck with me all these years, and I don't want to mess it up. I came here out of darkness in order to stop running from myself. As an individual, I avoided confronting myself and being confronted by others. Thus, I was alone, searching for a happiness that was only within myself. Nowhere else but here at Share will I begin to face reality. Only by being honest with myself and others, by being responsible for my actions, and being here when someone turns to me will I begin to grow. And we learned to do that. And I was there for 90 days. And then I went to aftercare for 90 days. And that's when they started taking us out to meetings. And we learned how to go to an AA meeting. We learned how to go to an NA meeting. We learned how to be part of the program, how to be part of the fellowship. And we learned a lot. And then I did 90 days of outpatient aftercare with a therapist. My first counselor was a confirmed pothead. And I thought that was a joke until he told some of his story. And I was like, ooh, I didn't know you could use like that. The other one was a pure alcoholic, and he drank like till almost to death. The other one was a recovering heroin addict. Her name was Linda Ford, and she had a voice like this and nails and the whole nine yards. And She'd tell you things like, you'd be in group, and you'd say, well, I don't know. And she said, I don't know, don't work in this room. Yes, ma'am. But you know what? She walked me through and helped me to see where the eating disorder connected with my addiction and my alcoholism, and helped me to put it all into a perspective that I could turn to my higher power for, I could turn to God for, and get help with. And that's become a really, really big thing. After I got out of Share House, I worked at Eastern Michigan University for a year, and then suddenly the job wasn't there anymore. It became a union job, and we all could apply for it, but only one of us could have it. And so I started looking for jobs, and I found a job here in Virginia. I put out my resume. I thought, it's been 2 years. Will people even take the bait anymore? And I put them out there, and I got four offers that were not bad, but the one here was really good. But I thought, okay, this is James's will. I thought God's will was for me to be at Eastern Michigan University and to work at the university or be near my parents. And pardon me, runny nose. But that wasn't the way it was going to be. I was fighting tooth and nail, and everything was a battle. And I still wasn't getting what I wanted at Eastern Michigan University. And when I turned to the job in Virginia, it was like flicking a domino on one of those little domino trails. It just all worked like magic. And I came here in the fall of 1998 and have found it was just an amazing fellowship and in AA. And again, my home group is the Oceanfront Men's Meeting. I've also been a part of Larchmont 12 and 12. I'm also part of Mixed Group Narcotics Anonymous. I'm also, on and on and on. And I, when I first got here, I came on a Tuesday. I found my apartment on Wednesday, moved in on Thursday, and Friday I worked. And at the end of the day, everybody I worked with just disappeared. I thought, oh, crap. They were all gone. They all had things to do. And I thought, as they were gone, I thought, I think I know where my apartment is. So it only took me a half hour to find it. It was six blocks. But I found it. And because they didn't let me do any of my connecting, I didn't have lights, I didn't have gas, I didn't have phone. And it was 95 degrees. So I thought, all right, you know what to do. I walked down to Colley Avenue to the 7-Eleven, and I picked up something that most young people in this program won't know what it is, a phone directory. And I opened it up, and I found the AA hotline. And I called them up, and I said, help, I'm new in town, and I need a meeting, and I need a meeting now. And the lady said, go over to First Lutheran on Colley Avenue. I don't know quite how far that is. You might want to drive. I'm not sure. I could have walked it. But I went over there, and I went to Candlelight. And from Candlelight, I went to Saturday Night Live the next night. And from Saturday Night Live, I went to Mixed Group, NA. And I was part of those home groups for a long time. And I thought, you know what, if I don't have work, I'm gonna go to a meeting. And so that's been my life here. I still go to three to four meetings a week. I still think it's of vital importance. And right now, I've been on a really important journey, because one of the things in the big book that I think is absolutely vital to me is the story about Jim, the guy who had the automotive company, but he lost it to drinking. And they have a really great thing in there that I hope I can find. I can find it when I don't want it. And when I want it, I usually can't find it. Let's see. At any rate, I think I can just ad lib it. It says, we told Jim, he came to us after a big drunk, and we told him what we knew about alcoholism, and he embraced the program. He embraced what we told him. And then one of the most important things in the entire big book, and all went well for a while, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And he's drunk again. So enlarging the spiritual life for me has been huge, and it's been a gigantic journey. When I was working with my I had a sponsor in Detroit, and it was an older lady. Her name was Carol. And Carol was hard on me. Carol was really hard on me. I was I went to her. Well, let me tell you this little story, because I think this is really important. Carol was the one that I went to about my mom. And she's the one who said to me, "So your mom's going to take the guilt. What are you going to do with it?" When I came to Norfolk, I also found this older lady named Liz. And Liz M. was my sponsor for about 10 years. And Liz, as she said, I'm the sponsor of the few, not the many. And she was right. She made me work hard. When we got to step 11, she said, "You know, you have a very vague idea of what God is." And she said, "I think it's time that you really help to get to know your God. You know, you need to seek through prayer and meditation to improve that conscious contact." So we spent a year on step 11. We'd been through the steps twice already, and we spent a year on step 11, and I started exploring. And so I have kind of an interesting thing. She was an earth-based religion, Wicca. And so we would celebrate, you know, the changing of the seasons and the changing of the year, and we would do all of that kind of stuff. And then she became very involved in Thich Nhat Hanh and Zen Buddhism and meditation. So I followed her into that and got into a lot of meditation and Eastern philosophy, which led me to Thomas Merton, who was a dear friend, the Buddha, or the Trappist monk, who was a very dear friend of Thich Nhat Hanh's. And they wrote together and worked together until he died of electrocution in the East. But at any rate, that's not the point. And then one day I thought, you know what, I love ritual, I love prayer, I love meditation, I love all of this. And I thought, I might as well go back to Catholicism and let them do all the ritual. So I went back because it was what I knew. But you know, the biggest thing is improving my conscious contact with God as I understand God. And you know, I belong to a Catholic church because I like the way they do things. Do I agree with everything they say? No. Do I have to agree with everything they say? Well, the people I know in the church don't always necessarily agree either. But that's just my path. So if somebody says to me, "What are you?" I don't know. I don't know if I can do this. I say, "Well, I'm a Wiccan Buddhist Catholic," and that helps some of these new guys to say, "Oh, yeah, I can get with that. I don't have to be one thing." You know, when I came back to the church because I wanted to be there. Previously, I'd been there because I was forced to be there. I went away and I came back wanting it. So that led me to a point where I wanted to be more deeply involved in prayer and meditation. I've never had a good relationship, romantic relationship. I don't do very well with that. I dated my best friend out of high school, Pat, and she and I dated for about 3 years. And then I totally screwed that up because I was a jackass. But we did become friends again, and I'm so glad we did, because I lost her last Christmas Day. She passed on. 52 years of like this. It has been rough. You know, that's one of the things, though. You know, the day my mother died was 2 days before my second anniversary here. And I went into the AA meeting and I told them, "My mom died." And everyone was very sympathetic and very, very supportive. And I said, "But you know what, only in AA can I mourn so deeply and so heavily on a Friday and celebrate so joyfully something that's this good on a Sunday when I had 2 years. That my mother could die and I didn't have to use over it," because that was the one that scared the hell out of me. That when my mother died, would I be able to handle it? Two years later, on the 9th of September, my NA hero, Al, succumbed to his depression and went down the basement and put a rifle in his mouth. 2 weeks later, my best friend, Dale, the one that I was roommates with in New York and friends for 22 years, he died in his sleep of heart failure at age 42. And 7 days later, my dad died. I didn't have to drink over it. I didn't have to use over it. I didn't even think of it. The first thing I thought of was call your sponsor and get to a meeting. You know, AA can walk me through anything. You know, there's nothing that I can't be walked through. And I've got it written in my basic text. It says, there's no problem so great that I can't make it worse by picking up. Everything gets worse if I pick up. But I have friends here. These three people are dear friends of mine from Larchmont that would come on, take their Friday night and come out and listen to me tell a story that Scott just heard last week. I think he's fact-checking on me. It has opened me up to be able to free to explore different things. Like I went about 10 years ago, I decided maybe I want to become a Trappist monk. And so I explored that. I explored that for 2 years. I went to a place in Berryville called Holy Family Monastery, and I went to Mepkin Abbey in Monk's Corner near Charleston, South Carolina. And I discerned. And I went right up to the edge. But at the end of the day, what I realized was that as much as I love that, I told the guys, I said, guys, I love you guys so much. They're such cool people. They take everything in stride. They take everything in stride, mostly. Okay, not everything. But I said to them, I want to be one of you guys so bad. I'm not. Because as my sponsor told me, I'm uniquely qualified to help the next alcoholic coming down the pike. And that's what my calling is. And that's good enough, right? That's good enough. So I'm going to wrap up with two things that my sponsor gave me. I love this. Mickey M. gave me this. My friend, when we decide to turn our will and our life over to the care of God, we're performing an act of courage. God has given us freedom to make our own choices. When we surrender our will, we are putting our fate in the hands of a power we don't always understand. God's will for us may be something we think we are not all ready for, such as a new vocation, a new partner, a new life. It could mean anything God has planned for us. Accepting those possibilities takes courage. To ask God's will for ourselves without reservation, without bargaining, is scary. But it is also a great relief. With the death of our self-will, the weight of the world comes off our shoulders and stays off if we stay in tune with our God. And a prayer that I will leave you with. Daily prayer. Dear Lord, I'm proud to say so far today, I've got along all right. I have not gossiped, whined, or bragged, or had a single fight. I haven't lost my temper once, or criticized my mate. I have not lied, I have not cried, or loudly cursed my fate. So far today, I've not one time been grumpy or morose. I've not been spiteful, cold, or vain, self-centered, or verbose. But Lord, I'm going to need your help throughout the hours ahead. So give me strength, dear God, for now I'm getting out of bed. Thanks, guys.